Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome to our final contemporary issues for the year. So I don't know if that makes this like just bordering on past issues or if we get future issues next. I don't remember how that works. So this is our final go-round with some issues for faithful voters. It's a second installment specifically of decoding scare words, some of those words that can be thrown around, used, misused in sort of the contentious political world that we find ourselves in. The word that I want us to talk about today is the word racism. So I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about socialism, one of the reasons that I want us to decode some of these scare words is in order not to bear false witness against our neighbor, which is an important piece of just how do we communicate with each other, right? Can we communicate with each other in a way that's actually fair and honest? I think we have a specific additional need to look at a word like racism that is a hard word for us white folks. And the reason is that we're white folks. Jesus said the thing about, you know, before you remove the speck from somebody else's eye, remove the plank from your own eye. And for historical cultural reasons, we as white Americans have a plank in our eye around this word racism. The idea is to be able to see ourselves a little bit more clearly as we deal with this word. So I first want to ask, what do you hear when you hear the word racism? What do you hear when you hear the word racism?
I hear that whenever you give an opinion on something, if it's different from what the person hears, they say you're racist. I mean, it's just a catch-all word, really.
So it can sound to us as a word that is just dismissive of our opinions and perhaps our questions. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. What else do you hear when you hear the word racism?
So often it's accusatory.
So often accusatory.
I find myself immediately getting defensive.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah. So we find ourselves getting defensive when we hear the word racism.
You hear it used a lot on television, you know, when they're, what seems like when they're interviewing black people. African American, to be more exact, and they throw that out at white people. You're racist, you know.
So the word
your feelings towards them is racist.
So the word racist is particularly current right now among people of color. I'm going to ask us to be very, very, very attentive to the way that we hear the word racism when used by people of non-white races. Because that's where the word racism has come into really such prominence in the past handful of years. We had sort of a time that we imagined that we were done with racism. And the national conversation in the past handful of years has reminded us that we're not done with racism. Because if the word is still current and active, then we must not be done with it. So this is sort of a complicated place to sit as we think about what is this word, what does it mean, and how can we both use it and hear it fairly. So I'm entering this conversation from a very specific thesis, if you will. My thesis is that we live in a racist nation. And I mean that not in the sense that we all as individuals walk around with bigoted attitudes, although that is also true. But that's not actually what I mean when I say we live in a racist nation. What I mean is that there is historically racism built into how we operate and go through the world. So that's a challenging thing to, a challenging and uncomfortable thing to say, particularly as a white person to a room full of white people. But if we don't talk about racism as white people, it doesn't get better. So I'm going to start with some dictionary definitions of racism. These first three are all from Random House. So I'm going to invite you to see sort of at some different levels what the word racism means. And let me know if, as you see these different levels, let me know if you see something that you're like, wait a minute, that's not what, you know, that's outside the scope of what this word means. So racism, hatred or intolerance of another race or other races. We're good so far? Let's get more sophisticated. A belief or doctrine that inherent differences among human racial groups determine cultural or individual achievement, usually involving the idea that one's own race is superior and has the right to dominate others, or that a particular racial group is inferior to the others. So that's a more sophisticated way of talking about this hatred or intolerance, and it also, it brings it into sort of a mental framework, right? It's not just, oh, I can't stand those people, but I have told myself a story in which my racial group is better than their racial group. Is what? Smarter, harder working, more ethical, safer to be around. So I've told myself this story in which my racial group is honestly better entitled to the good things of life than that other racial group. But that's still something about attitudes, right? What about a policy, system of government, and so on, based upon or fostering such a doctrine, the way of thinking, the mental model that we just talked about, based upon or fostering such a doctrine, semicolon, discrimination.
First thing I thought about when I read that was Nazis. That time at World War II.
Yeah. So the Nazi Party in Germany during World War II and the run-up to World War II explicitly espoused a set of policies that were built around a doctrine of racial superiority, specifically this myth of Aryanism, right? Which was not just white supremacy, it was like white supremacy plus, right? Because there's a very specific set. The Aryan race is the race that is superior to all the others and should rule the others. And there were a very in-depth set of laws and regulations that specifically targeted the Jewish people, but also targeted anybody else who didn't fit what Aryanism was supposed to be, which included Other ethnic groups, especially the Roma, included communists, included LGBTQ people, included people with developmental differences, people who just were categorized as antisocial, whatever that meant, according to this set of policies. Can anybody point to racist policies and systems closer to home? The Nazis are easy to disagree with.
Well, I think you can see an attempt at it right now with separating children from their parents and saying who comes into the country at the border.
So
for example, calling everybody from south of the border rapists and thieves and
drug dealers and
yes.
Yeah. So
so we're trying to build a wall and a system of government that everybody agrees with that you can't come in unless you are a specific person.
So you're wanting to make an argument that that set of immigration policies and practices, right? Policies as a legal framework, enforcement practices as an executive framework, which generally speaking predate this administration, are based upon or fostering a belief or doctrine that inherent differences among human racial groups determine cultural or individual achievement and so forth. So, I think you could make that argument. I think there are probably some gaps in that argument. And so that's one of those places where, yeah, the rubber would hit the road in talking about how do we talk about racism as faithful voters. Can you look at the history of the United States and find some incontrovertibly racist policies and systems?
In your Jim Crow era?
There you go. The Jim Crow era. So there was a civil war. The North won. There was Reconstruction. The South won, right? Reconstruction was an attempt to put the racial system of the United States together, and it got flipped into Jim Crow laws that were policies and systems specifically based on perpetuating racial disparities in the United States.
And we really began that as a country with the Native Americans when they were put on reservations and not allowed to join,
right,
become one country. They were separated. So it started way back, and we did it again in World War. I always get this confused. The Japanese internment camps.
That was World War II.
World War
II. Yeah.
We did that again, and so we've continued to do that.
Right.
And so my kids being Korean, I never imagined that they would face any of this, and yet every one of them will tell you multiple stories of it happening in our communities. Of the most common one that all three have heard is being called banana by their friends. And I was coarse as a white American, was like, what? What's banana? And it was yellow on the outside, white on the inside, because they're adopted into a Caucasian parent.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
I've never heard of that. It's pretty commonplace. So
yeah.
So it happens in all different ways.
So it's still happening.
Oh, definitively.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
So,
but they're also supposed to be really good at math because they're Asian.
Right.
Unfortunately or unfortunately, all
my
kids are really good at math. So,
so there's a there's a whole
that.
Sort of the way that
there's positives and negatives.
Yeah, and it's
sorta.
Positives and negatives, and there's positive stereotypes and negative stereotypes, and what does it mean? The term that's often used in sort of anti-racist conversation. So. Trying to say, okay, here's racism, we're gonna do something about it. One of the terms that's commonly used is model minority. English speaking Caucasian people are the majority, the dominant racial group, one way or another. Even envisioning a future where demographically English speaking white folks will not be the numeric majority, we're going to continue to be the dominant culture, at least for quite some time beyond that, because of the power, status, privilege, money, access to the levers of power that we still have. One of the ways that this doctrinal definition of racism stays in place, one of the ways that the ideology of racism stays in place, is to look at black and brown people, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, people from South Asia are different from people from East Asia, according to the way that, and Southeast Asia is especially different, right? So this is this sort of splitting other racial groups into sets, and then saying, you know what? Koreans and Chinese kids are really good at math, and they're well-behaved, and they're very musical, and so on and so on, not only sort of confines the kids themselves, but also sets them up as, this is what you should be, all you other black and brown people, right? It's a way of enforcing that stereotype. Roger.
Seems to me that the big debate over the Declaration of Independence was about this. That all men are created equal or not.
So the Declaration of Independence included that line, that all men are created equal, which is men and white men. And by the time we had a constitution, white men who owned property in order to be able to vote, right? So there have always been these ways baked into the United States of America of making sure that we white people get to stay at the center. And we white men specifically who own property, although my mortgage lender owns the property, I just borrow it from them.
Yes.
But yeah, and not the women.
And not the women.
And not people who don't speak English, and So here's a set of three sort of parameters for talking about racism. So I'm trying to sort of get us a workable set of ways to talk about this. And this is by an academic named Steve Garner, who studies racism. And he says there are three things that make racism. One is a historical hierarchical power relationship between groups. So there has to be an uneven power relationship. There needs to be a set of ideas about racial differences. So a way of kind of making ideological sense of the power imbalance. And then third, there need to be discriminatory actions or practices. So racism isn't just a mental thing. I would argue it's not even primarily a mental thing. It is primarily a matter of action. Just like repentance is not primarily a matter of feeling badly about what you did, it's primarily a matter of changing, right? Historical hierarchical power relationship between groups. So the historical piece matters. That's why I wanted to bring it home to the United States, because we kind of know our history, and sometimes we have to remember the pieces of our history that we don't want to remember, and that there's a power relationship. A set of ideas that makes that power relationship seem to make sense, at least to those in power, and discriminatory actions within that. Or, here's another way to put it, this is Cynthia Silva Parker. Racism is a system of oppression created to justify social, political, and economic hierarchy. So that sort of boils down that previous set of three parameters. Okay, we want to get to the root of racial injustice. So I have here for our next 20 minutes Megan Ming Francis. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Washington, where she specializes in the study of American politics, race, and the development of constitutional law. She knows her stuff. She is particularly interested in the construction of rights and citizenship, Black political activism, and the post-Civil War South. Her award-winning book, Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State, shows that the battle against lynching and mob violence in the first quarter of the 20th century were pivotal to the development of civil rights and the growth of federal court power. She is inspired by people who fight for justice even when the end appears nowhere in sight. Here is Megan Ming Francis. Give her just a moment.
She's Buffy.
That's right.
Yes. And you have to turn it off and on three times.
After we move the whole thing.
It's almost the interesting one.
It's the same job. It's the same
job. That's right, we're always talking. I want you to do it. Like, that's a lot of guessing. We're pressing
the whole thing. So I thought, oh, it's my name.
I just finished teaching Introduction to American Politics to a group of eager undergraduates. This was my first year teaching, but I pulled off a slamming lecture, and I was feeling good about myself. As I left the classroom, I looked down at my phone and saw that I had 5 missed calls from my brother Kenny. At the time, Kenny was a student at Temple University and living in North Philly. For those who don't know North Philly, it's an area that is predominantly Black and low income with a very visible police presence. When I return his phone call, Kenny is loud and swearing into the phone. I can tell that something very bad happened, but I'm not sure what. When I'm finally able to get him to calm down, he tells me how he was sitting on the stoop of his building talking to a friend, when 4 police officers ran up on him and threw him and 3 others on the ground, handcuffed them, and then pushed them up against a wall, all the while asking them, "What drugs do you have? What drugs do you have?" Kenny had no drugs. He told the officers this many times, but each statement of "no drugs" only seemed to provoke more force and make the officers more upset. As Kenny sat cuffed and slumped against a brick wall, he quietly told the officers that he was a student at Temple University, and without reason, they could not hold him. The officers finally retrieved his college ID, which was in his wallet that had slipped out when he was slammed to the pavement, realized that he was indeed in college without drugs, and then let him go. After Kenny told me the story, he was still loud and upset. I was shaking, barely able to hold the phone to my ear, all of the joy from my great day of teaching gone, and replaced with a deep sense of helplessness and alarm. I wanted to remove the hurt and frustration that Kenny felt, that I could hear so clearly through the phone, but I neither had the will nor the ability to lie to him about the mightiness of American racism, and we both silently knew that this would not be the last time that he would be stopped and frisked by the police for drugs. In an attempt to try to calm him down and to shift attention onto something that he perhaps did have control over, I had this genius idea and suggested that he focus his attention on schoolwork to kind of take his mind off of things. He yells into the phone at me, "What is that going to do? Why should I focus on my schoolwork when the police are allowed to do things like this?" And then he says to me, "I'm not a student in your class, Megan. Your books are not going to save me." I silently nodded on the other end of the phone. In a lifetime of often heated exchanges with him, I've probably never been more wrong, and he has never been more right. Kenny is not alone. This violent interaction between black men and women and police officers plays out in cities and towns across the United States, often with much more devastating results. According to the most recent statistics, blacks are 3 times more likely to be shot and killed by police than whites. The question on everyone's mind, and the question that I get asked the most, is how do we solve this problem? And I confess, I cringe at this question. Not because it's not a good question, but because I think we're asking the wrong question. I'm not convinced we even understand how we got to this point in the first place. Better understanding of the root causes of the current place where we are will help provide us the tools that we need to move us forward. However, even I confess that even I sometimes am more eager to solve a problem than I am to understand it. So a few years ago, I adopted a corgi from a shelter and named him President Bartlett off of the West Wing. Now he's super adorable, but he was abused, and he's very aggressive whenever he sees another dog. My fix in my first year was to walk him at crazy hours of the day, but this worked only marginally well, and I was stressed and tired. The following year, I decided to hire a trainer to try to figure out the underlying issues behind his reactive behavior. On the first day of our meeting, the trainer looks at me and says, "Fixes that do not address the root causes of an issue are not really fixes at all." I realized that in my haste to fix President Bartlett, I actually had made him worse. The present crisis surrounding race in the United States, I think, suffers from a lack of attention to the root causes. Better attention to the root causes, I am convinced, will help us to figure out how to move past where we are right now in terms of the current racial climate in the United States. So why does the killing of unarmed blacks continue to happen? I think it continues to happen because we have the wrong diagnosis and the wrong cure. And what I mean by this is we tend to think the problem of racial violence is isolated to a few stubborn racists, right, that haven't yet drunk kind of this progressive Kool-Aid. And we tend to think the cure to racial injustices in the United States should always revolve around education. In the rest of my talk today, I'm going to challenge both of these ideas and suggest a new way to understand the problem as well as the solution. First, part of the reason the killing of unarmed blacks continues to happen at an alarming rate is because we haven't properly addressed our long history of racial terror in this country, which has treated blackness as a proxy for criminality, as a substitute for criminality. Instead, when confronted with kind of these jarring racial injustices, what we like to do is to point to the bad racist apples. We like to individualize the problem and situate it away from us. This is why we're able to make sense of, let's say, a Dylann Roof, the shooter in Charleston, South Carolina, who shot up the black church and had a white power manifesto. But the problem of contemporary racial violence is not that we have a few kind of racist bad apples. The problem is that the whole tree, the whole apple tree, is infected. The problem is that the presumption of dangerousness is tightly bound to race for so many in this country. For police officers to justify the use of deadly force, they have to reasonably believe that their lives are in danger. And all the high-profile killings of blacks over the past year, officers attest to feeling under threat. But what does this mean in the context of unarmed citizens? It means that black skin triggers a heightened sense of threat, a life-threatening sense of threat, that then influences the officer's decision to use deadly force. According to the most recent statistics, 33% of blacks that have been killed by police were unarmed. But it's not just police that prop up this myth of black danger. This myth gets reinforced and takes on a truth-like quality through everyday interaction. When a black man passes and a woman clutches her purse, or when a group of black friends walk by a car, and hear the jarring sound of someone who has just pushed their automatic locks because they are afraid. And I have friends on both sides of this. Black men with great jobs who just want to be viewed as a person and not as a threat after a long day of work. And I have really great white and Asian woman friends who clutch their purse and walk quickly if they see a black man on a dimly lit street, and then feel ashamed and a need to over-explain their actions to me. And I've also been on the receiving end of having who I was reduced to someone else's false perception of how much of a danger I posed. Last year, I was coming back from a trip, and I was singled out by the TSA agent. I thought that I had left a water bottle, like I often do, in my bag. But he ushered me to a separate area, and then two more TSA agents surrounded me. And I knew in my gut that something bad was about to go down. The lead TSA agent proceeds to accuse me of bringing a weapon into the airport. When I insisted that I did not bring a weapon into the airport, he produces a piece of costume jewelry, a double ring that I had picked up for $4 on vacation. It was like his gotcha moment, and it was my super confused moment. He then accuses me of bringing brass knuckles, a deadly weapon, into a United States airport. I was almost at a loss of words, which is rare for someone like me, but I politely pointed out to him that the ring was plastic, it wasn't brass, and these weren't knuckles, it was just a ring that went over two fingers instead of one finger. But have you ever talked to someone and felt like you didn't exist? Like when they spoke to you, they spoke right through you. Well, that's how I felt. He got more angry at my explanations, looked me in my face, and said, "You people always lie. I know that this is a weapon, and I'm not going to let someone dangerous like you board a plane today." Well, I started to shake, right? Because we've all seen this movie about the brown girl who walks into the airport with a deadly weapon, and it never really ends well for her. And doesn't. It never does. So I had to do what I hate doing, and I used my credentials to get me out of a bad situation. I told him that I was a professor of constitutional law and American politics. Right? So I told him, I cited U.S. Criminal Code, landmark Supreme Court decisions, and rules from the Homeland Security Rulebook, because I also teach civil liberties. And then he started to get very nervous. He asked what school I worked at. I told him, he Googled my name, and the blood drained from his face, right? As he realized I wasn't making this up, I knew my rights, and I was a college professor. And then when he looked back at me, he finally saw me. Not as a dangerous threat, but as a person. After a few more minutes, he let me go to catch my much-delayed flight. I found a seat in the airport terminal, still trembling with rage at the way that I had been treated. I was only seated for a few minutes when I felt a tap on my shoulder. A woman airport worker said that she saw my whole ordeal and that he does this all the time to black passengers, and I was lucky to have been released from his custody so quickly. But it shouldn't take a university website profile to be viewed as non-threatening, right? Like it just... part of the reason I share this story and some of the other ones is that I think in talking about the current racial crisis, we tend to focus all of our attention on police and overlook our own complicity in creating an environment in which black lives are not treated as equal. To be clear in thinking about solutions to the racial violence, I'm in favor of body cameras. I'm in favor of a non-militarized police force. I'm in favor of stricter laws that make police officers more accountable when they stop and frisk people on the street. But I'm not convinced that we would need something like body cameras if we didn't live in a society that treated blacks as dangerous and suspicious first, and as citizens second. It's not just a few bad racist apples in a police department or at an airport. It's all of us who, in big ways through our actions and in small ways by our silences, support this lie, because that's what it is, right? It's a lie that somehow black folk are just more dangerous than the rest of us. So not only do I believe that we've misdiagnosed the problem, I also think we have the wrong cure to it. We keep offering up education as a solution to all racial injustices in the United States. It's kind of what I call sometimes in my classes as the Robitussin of civil rights. I mean, like, when I was little, my mom like loved Robitussin. She would give me it. I got cold, Robitussin, flu, Robitussin, right? Like allergies, like Robitussin. Like, where's the Benadryl? But just like Robitussin is not a cure-all for all types of sicknesses, education is not a cure-all for all of America's racial sins. And yet, education is still how most Americans understand their responsibility to fixing contemporary racial injustices. Our measure of how far we have come in the area of race relations is most often calculated in how integrated our schools are, how many innovative education experiments are currently going on, and how many federal dollars are committed towards education. But the problem, the contemporary problem surrounding the killing of unarmed blacks is not a problem that boils down to providing greater educational opportunities to blacks. This is a misdiagnosis. A book is not going to stop the bullet barreling through a gun at Rekia Boyd in Chicago. And longer classroom times are not going to save Freddie Gray from being illegally stopped and manhandled by police in Baltimore. This is what I know for sure, that in order to combat continuing racial injustices today, we must expand our vision and our responsibility to what civil rights actually means. We must include the battle against racist violence in our understanding of civil rights. Instead of education, what if we place freedom from racist violence at the crux of what it means to be free and equal in the United States? Doing so does not mean that we necessarily dislodge education, but it means that if racism and white supremacy are a rock fortress, that we assemble a greater arsenal of weapons to break the damn thing down. Now, I know this is not an easy task, but I know that it can be done. So in my real life, I'm a political scientist and a historian, and I've spent the last 10 years focused on a surprising finding. That before the civil rights group, the NAACP, focused on its historic campaign against segregated education, the NAACP spent the first two decades of the 20th century focused on fighting escalating levels of racial violence that blacks endured as a result of the actions from police, politicians, and private white citizens in the South and in the North. In order to wage this big campaign against racial violence, the NAACP organized mass demonstrations in the streets. They lobbied Congress to pass an anti-lynching bill. They litigated and won a landmark decision in front of the Supreme Court. And they petitioned three different presidents to make a statement against lynching. It was this massive, extraordinary, in-your-face campaign that forced America to confront lynchings and mob violence against African Americans. It asked America how strong was its commitment to protecting black lives. As a result of this work in the early 20th century, the rates of lynching and mob violence dramatically decreased. I tell this story about the NAACP's historic kind of campaign against racial violence because I believe our past history can light a way out of the present darkness. If we listen to what this history tells us, then we must struggle through this current moment. We must confront the ways that our actions and our institutions lead to a differential treatment of blacks, even if done unintentionally. Today, people across the United States are taking to streets and are demanding to be seen. Not as dangerous, but as people whose lives have value and deserve protection. Some of these groups are associated directly and some indirectly with the Black Lives Matter movement. Without the efforts of these groups, so many of these killings of unarmed blacks would have been swept under the rug and we would have lost attention long ago. But so many of these activists have denied the comforts of silence, and they are being active around this issue. Their message and my message to you today is that we must pay closer attention to the way that Black people are treated. The stories of police brutality and killings of unarmed Blacks is not a story about Black people. It's a story about all of us, about racial progress and the stubborn durability of American racism. It's about if we will stop making the mistakes of our past and confront our own complicity in this great American lie that somehow Black people are more dangerous than others. And finally, it's about if we have the courage to take a collective stand against racial injustice today. This year, nearly half of my students in my Race and Politics Upper Division course participated in a walkout in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. Halfway through my lecture, I could hear the swelling crowd of students, teachers, and community members in the quad at the University of Washington. I smiled to myself as I had a flashback to the conversation that I had with Kenny, now 5 years ago. He was right, of course. My books and my silence will not save these students, but their activism, their courage in challenging the status quo, and this movement just might.
Here's Megan's brother, Kenny. Your books are not going to save me. Blacks are 3 times more likely to be shot and killed by police than whites are. 33% of Blacks who are shot and killed by police are unarmed. So put those two sets of numbers together, right? And she says, the question is not how do we solve this problem, because we don't understand this problem. And so she wants to point back to the root causes of this crisis in the United States racial climate. She says, the wrong way of thinking about it is that there are bad apples and that this can be solved with education. Instead, she points to this history of racial terror. That's the ideology, right? This cultural way of saying that Blackness and criminality are the same thing, which is, you know, that ideology as an implicit part of how you go through the world is why, or at least how, police officers apparently more often feel that fear for their own safety when interacting with Black people. And I'm not saying that because I'm accusing police officers of having a certain set of mental attitudes. I'm following the evidence, right? If Blacks are 3 times more likely than whites to be shot and killed by the police, and the way that a police officer makes a decision whether they need to use deadly force is whether they feel concern for their safety, I'm just following cause and effect there. Right? But she also points out that we can see that in our own interactions with people of color. So she says, yes, we need accountability for police officers, but we also need more fundamental work to address racism as it exists culturally in the United States. And she points to that the work that the NAACP did in the first half of the 20th century, sort of before we, as we conventionally tell the story, look at the civil rights movement, right? Like, we imagine the civil rights movement began in 1954 in Montgomery, and that's not when it started, right? The NAACP was working specifically to say, let's not lynch Black people, right? Over decades before that. And then it was able to, 54 was Brown v. Board, Montgomery was later than that. Right year, wrong thing. So before that shift to education, and then of course the Montgomery bus boycott was was a shift to segregation society-wide economically. First, the NAACP was insisting on the value of black lives. Right? That's what an anti-lynching campaign is about. So I don't have a lot of time left. I need to leap us to January. So I just kind of want to give Megan the last word on racism, because she lives it from an angle that I don't live it. Betty?
I'm not saying that there are not bad policemen, but I am saying that I'm sure many of those policemen had been threatened many times by other people.
Yes, and. Yes, and. I want to really give credit to law enforcement officers who do work that I'm not cut out to do, and are, they get the bulletproof vest and the weapon because their job involves going into situations that are not safe. For the same reason that firefighters have bunker suits and helmets, right? And there is a numerical difference in outcomes for white people and black people dealing with the police. And that is irrespective of the fact that police officers are doing a job that is dangerous. 33% of the African Americans who are shot and killed by police are unarmed. How are they more dangerous than white folks? Right?
This comes into the part where we started, the discrimination.
Right. And so this is a discriminatory outcome.
Right.
Right? And I think Dr. Francis is trying to be very explicit that this is not about individual police officers making good or bad decisions. This is about a cultural momentum that police officers are operating within. And there are we could dig even deeper into that. Some of the factors that contribute. One is implicit bias, which is a measurable thing. So how fast, this is part of the defense in every individual case, right? The police officer has to make a snap decision about whether they are safe in this situation or not, right? Those snap decisions are influenced by the implicit judgments that we bring, right? And that same implicit bias is present. It may be more or less implicit. It may be explicit, depending on sort of how long a person has to react. But the woman clutching her purse when people of color walk by, the locking your car door when people of color walk by, those are decisions that are made not typically because people say, oh, that's a person of color, I've learned this story about people of color, I'm going to do this thing that is discriminatory against them. But that is a discriminatory action that is made for some reason, right? The difference with law enforcement is that the decisions are so fast, and they're armed, and they're as a rule armed, right? And there is a whole lot of latitude, a whole lot of discretion given to that use of force. I am not, at least before Stand Your Ground laws, I am not as an untrained private citizen allowed to use deadly force without trying to de-escalate a situation. simply because I feel unsafe is not reason for, is not just cause, legally speaking, for me to use deadly force. It is just cause, legally speaking, for a law enforcement officer to use deadly force. Now, we could discuss whether that amount of latitude is correct, but that amount of latitude exists. One could argue that that amount of latitude exists in order to sort of maintain the established unjust racial dynamic, but you can also make the argument that that latitude exists because they have a really hard job. I don't want to downplay how hard that job is. But it's a job that is dangerous not only for the law enforcement officer. A second huge factor in the that disparity between outcomes for white folks and people of color in interactions with law enforcement is that people of color have way more interactions with law enforcement than white people do. We might stand next to them in the line at Dunkin' Donuts, right? But this is statistically demonstrated. African Americans, especially African American men, are pulled over by the police at rates way, way higher than white people are. Arrested and prosecuted for drug-related offenses, way, way more often, despite statistically identical rates of drug use. Or of moving violations. Yeah, we do need to wrap this up and go to church.
Don't
we?
Yeah. This is the only thing that I find extremely frustrating.
Yeah.
Is that, well, it's not one of the, it's one of the things I find extremely frustrating, but is that you can identify the problem,
mm-hmm.
but it is, what do we do
right.
to help change this? It sounds right. like it's a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
That you need to change at a very low rate. It goes back to, you go back to even some of the things like we've seen. If you went to the play South Pacific, mm-hmm. and the one song that always comes through is "You've Got to Be Taught to Hate and Fear mm-hmm. from Year to Year," and it's very true on that. There's also so many other groups that we tend to find. To discriminate against, it's easier for people like your children because they're identifiable from a white person or black people, mm-hmm. but you can't necessarily identify someone who is gay, or you can't or when certain people are being discriminated against, you just see the injustice, but. It just feels overwhelming that you don't know how to even
right.
start.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't have solutions for you today.
We'll work on that.
Right.
Next week.
Yeah. So unfortunately, there is no next week. We're coming back in January. Coming back in January, we're going to shift the conversation, although bring this especially with you, white folks who go to church in West Des Moines. Bring this conversation about racism and everything we've talked about this fall to a conversation about the book Neighborhood Church. Look for details in your Covenant Corner email on Tuesday. Go to church.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.